Welcome to the Apria podcast series. This episode finds us in conversation with Christian Mancini, Chief Executive Officer, Asia Pacific, excluding Greater China at Savills. Journalist Mark Cooper talks to Chris about his early days in real estate and his 20-year-plus career in Japan, where he still runs the Savills business alongside his regional commitments. Chris also opines on the changes the COVID-19 outbreak may bring to real estate investment in the Asia-Pacific region. A wide-ranging discussion also takes in Chris's advice to his younger self, the duties of a regional CEO, and the evolving world of the real estate advisor.
This is Mark Cooper for the Apria podcast, and today I'm with Chris Mancini, Chief Executive for Asia Pacific, excluding China, at Savills. Welcome, Chris.
Hello, Mark.
So we're going to, as is normal with these, have a bit of a mix of a conversation, talking about some personal things, your background, about your role with Savills, and some thoughts about the market. And in terms of the personal, you've been in Japan for a long time, and obviously head of Japan for Savills before you took on this regional role. So what I'd like to do is go back kind of to the beginning and see what brought you to Japan in the first place, and how from there did you move into real estate?
Right. So how did I get to Japan in the first place? I was, as many misanthropic young men in their early 20s upon finishing university, with the oh-so-marketable and lucrative philosophy degree that I had in my hands, I had occasion to come to Japan courtesy of an introduction from a friend who was working in, had his own software company, a game software developer. And he said, look, why don't you come along and I'll make sure that you've got a job when you land, and think about, spending a year here and then, go back to the United States and pursue. I looked at doing a couple of advanced degrees, a master's in something, or possibly going to law school. And he said, this will be a great little bit of buffer between then and now. Make your way here and I'll ensure that you're gainfully employed. And that was in December of 1993. And then I had found myself standing in Narita Airport, February of 1994, and I've never been back since. That was the genesis of me. I had no particular understanding of or overwhelming interest in Japan. It was an opportunity that presented itself, and it seemed like the only time in my life I'd be able to take it up, somebody up on it. And so I did. The real estate piece came considerably later. And without boring you with too much minutiae, Japanese labor law is such that it's very hard to hire foreigners as full-time employees if you think there's any possibility that they're going to leave and head back to the United States or the UK or wherever they may hail from. So everyone is basically put on these hybrid temporary contracts or short-term contracts. And there was a cottage industry in the 90s of, I refer to them as glorified temp agencies, where they would, field needs or requirements from large Japanese corporates that would otherwise never think of employing a foreigner directly, and trot you through them on 3 to 6 month contracts. And after I'd cycled through a shipping company, an advertising agency, I had occasion, and a trading company, I had occasion to go and work for a large Japanese general contractor. And that's what I did. I call it one of the greatest jobs I've ever had. I learned, it was like going to university a second time and getting paid. And that sort of was the kickoff to my real estate career. Back again in the, I'm going to go late 90s.
Late 90s. And did you move from there to Savills?
No, I had interim stops in between. I went from the general contractor to an American architecture firm as their head of marketing and business development in Japan. I went from that shortly after the 9/11 incident. I went from there to a subsidiary of General Motors, GMAC Commercial Mortgage, that was involved in asset and property management, principal investment, non-performing loan investment, and acquisition, using a combination of the General Motors pension fund as its equity source, as well as having a third party business. And I was in their asset and property management business. Savills came along when the General Motors unfunded pension liabilities came to light in 2003-ish. Savills, which had not had a presence in Japan, raised their hands and asked for an opportunity to buy, and subsequently did complete on the acquisition of the AM and PM business of GMAC. And I've been with the business. That was in November of 2004, feels right. In November, December of 2004. And I've been with the business since then.
Okay. And so you were involved in growing that into more of a full service business, or fully service business for Savills in Japan.
Yes. We started out, there were 14 people doing asset and property management. And I was a director in charge of a handful of divisions, which you can imagine with only 14 people is a relatively easy management undertaking. The business grew quite quickly. And by 2007, we'd had, three offices with 50 odd staff that was sadly wildly unprofitable and terribly misguided in its undertaking. The gentleman who ran the business at the time elected to step down, and I was asked to take over, and we very quickly shuttered both of the two non-Tokyo offices, or the one non-Tokyo office and the one non-institutionally focused Tokyo office. So we shut down a resi business and an Osaka office. We trimmed headcount down to we were back almost to where we started. We had maybe 18, 19 people when the pruning exercise was complete. And today we sit at 78, 79 people thereabouts, and cover off pretty much all of the traditional IPC services lines.
Okay, great. So that's a fair stint in Japan and Japanese real estate. I've noticed that there's probably quite a small group of guys who are foreign real estate professionals who've been in Tokyo for sort of 20 odd years. Would you say there's anything that group of people have particularly in common that's kind of kept them in Japan for that time, particularly in that sort of Tokyo institutional business?
Yeah, I mean, broadly speaking, no. I mean, there is the what gets latticed on top of everyone is a fondness for the culture, a fondness for the market. And by fondness for the market, I mean the notion of gentlemanly trade, where, generally it's a market where people do what they say and they say what they're going to do. And there's a great deal of integrity on, all sides, whether it's, imagine this, agents are, generally duty-bound to adhere to their word and not be, terribly efficient gamesmen, but rather facilitate transactions and, render an important service. And your client side, whether they be domestic clients or whether they be foreign firms, whether they're funds or property companies, what have you, and regardless of jurisdiction or origin, there's a general expectation that everyone will behave in a gentlemanly fashion. And that is, perhaps a departure, or at least it's somewhat different from other markets in the world. And the idea that you can trade amongst those people is, that would be the one unifying characteristic. We've all done very different things. I mean, there's probably only, 20 of us, 30 of us, maybe more. We all have a red bat phone on the desk with a cake tray over it, and we call one another, even folks that work for our competitors. We're all in pretty regular contact with one another. And there's a general view that what we do represents an opening of a very, very large market in the world, and that anything we're able to do that is good for one or the other is good for us all. And there's a sense of solidarity and a sense of shared fate and fortune in an otherwise relatively insular market.
Have there been a lot of changes over your time there? And I'm thinking that one of the biggest changes for Japan is it gets far more foreign visitors of one sort or another, and perhaps more foreign investment, broadly speaking, over the years now than it used to, say, 10 or 20 years ago. Has that brought change as well?
It has. I mean, it's brought a degree of, there was a period of time where when you looked at real estate valuation in Japan, there was an assumption of the perpetual increase in the value of land. And then it was an adjustment or a calculation made based on what you thought construction costs were going to do over the next 12 to 24 months. You know, if you know, in the late 90s, if you talk to people like, you know, about cap rates and discounted cash flow analysis, you may as well have been speaking Farsi. It was an absolutely unknown and non-understood principle. Now, I mean, Japanese underwriting models, whether you're talking about the listed REITs, the property companies, they've become infinitely more sophisticated. So, you know, I never had the pleasure of working in the real estate market outside of Japan until somewhat recently. But the, you know, Japan is somewhat and always has been resistant to change to a point. But when they do decide that they're going to collectively embrace that change, things transform very, very quickly. And that is, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s of Japanese real estate. You know, when once you have that transparency over valuation, or you have sort of a commonly accepted methodology, if you look at the durability of cash flow here, you know, it immediately became, you know, whereas I have a very distinct memory of going to the United States in the 90s and trying to sell buildings, you know, in conjunction with my colleagues and handlers and my Japanese bosses, of talking about buildings that were, you know, investment opportunities in Tokyo, that today you would have a blind stampede of people bidding to get into a piece of that or to take down an entire building by themselves. And we couldn't give them away because there was just no transparency in the market. Nobody knew how to value anything. Nobody knew what underlying rent structure looked like. You had, you know, under old Japanese lease law, you had a whale that would never get more than 6 months long, which made it terribly unappealing to institutional investors overseas. And today it's a very different place. It is, you know, as you and your readers and followers will well know, I mean, Japan and Australia tend to come out durably numbers one and two in terms, and you can add Singapore in there as well. So let's say that Japan is typically, or at least one of its major cities, is top three in Asia Pacific in terms of attracting investment capital. And that's been the case for north of a decade now. So, I mean, has it changed? Yeah, it's changed a lot. It's, you know, it's figured out that the insular notion of, you know, the island mentality that had plagued it for, you know, the decades, you know, prior, was no longer a tenable proposition. And, you know, they've become, the market and the practitioners in the market have become much more aware of globally how standards work, how debt works, how valuation work, what leasing should look like, you know, the terms and tenor of lease, the idea of a lease, a tenant in a building being a partner with the landlord as opposed to a necessary evil in the process. That's all come about in the past 20 years.
Interesting. Yeah. So Japan's changed a lot, but it still retains a unique character. I'm a big fan of the place as a visitor. So it's good to see that it retains that.
It does.
Do you have any regrets over your time there? I had a question for you. What advice would you give your 30-year-old self? I suppose the other thing is, you know, what would your 30-year-old self berate you about now if he could see you?
My 30-year-old self would have, you know, wished that I'd spent more time at the gym, perhaps. But I mean, professionally speaking, look, I mean, everyone has evolved pretty much in parallel, right? You know, from a professional standpoint, in marked contrast to other markets, you know, this is a country that we the notion of lifetime employment and the idea of, you know, a lack of career mobility has been something that's often derided and seen as somewhat antiquated and old fashioned. You know, the reality is that, like, that sentiment has never, and the merits and the value of that sentiment have never been more applicable, you know, than they are today. You know, Japan teaches you, there have been, everyone gets, you know, if I look back at my 30-year-old self and I think of the number of times that I had occasion to change jobs, in some instances, shifting, you know, aspects of the industry entirely, and, you know, I didn't take the bait, and it, you know, it's pointless for us to sit and imagine what might have been. But, you know, the one thing that I would laud my 30-year-old self for, if I can be so immodest, is the idea that, look, you make your bed and you lie in it. You take a job and you commit to making, you know, the absolute best out of what you can do, of whatever skills you may have in, you know, the corporate environment that you find yourself in. And, you know, that loyalty is more important than just about any other skill set that you may have. You know, we all have friends that have changed, that have worked for, you know, all of our competitors. We have friends that have had jobs with six and seven different funds. You know, and again, I begrudge those people nothing, but you know, the one valuable takeaway that I have from the time I've spent in this market is that there is, it's almost impossible to ascribe value to how important loyalty is, to how important it is to understand that the people that you work with, you're going to see as frequently as your family, that if you find a place where you are comfortable and feel as though you're philosophically aligned both with, you know, the corporate initiative and the people that you sit next to, you know, on your left and right each day, that the idea of picking up and changing just for, you know, $72 extra in your pay packet at the end of the month is, you know, is foolhardy. And it in that does more to undermine the career of otherwise wickedly talented professionals here than anything else. So, I mean, the advice I would give to my 30-year-old self was, you've done accidentally a couple of things right. I've never really worked for another real estate services firm other than Savills. They're in wonderful companies, though they all are. And the temptation has been there on more than one occasion. But you pick your battles. You pick your friends and you lie in the bed that you've made, if you'll forgive the cliche. What would I do differently? I don't know. I mean, you know, would I, you know, again, I'd probably have spent more time at the gym. Not necessarily a professional undertaking, but you know, I don't know that I would have discouraged 30-year-old Chris from doing much professionally differently than he has right now.
So that's good. No regrets. And you've done okay as well.
Not many anyway, yeah.
So your current job covers a fair few square miles and a lot of staff. So tell me a bit about kind of pre the current crisis, what the average day is like for you, or a typical day.
Obviously, it depends on where I would find myself. I am a resident now of Hong Kong. I mean, spiritually, Japan is my home. And I maintain a residence here, and I am, in fact, a permanent resident of Japan who intends, you know, several decades hence to retire in Japan. You know, when I'm here, I am largely maybe 70% of my days focused on Japan operational matters, whether they be, you know, transactional or administrative or client service based. When I'm in Hong Kong, which is where is my residence, I have far fewer clients there and far fewer operational responsibilities when I'm in Hong Kong. And it allows me the opportunity to be on the phone to my colleagues in Australia, in Singapore, in India, in some of our other Southeast Asian markets, and spend a bit more time, you know, being introspective and thinking about what, you know, solid strategy is for our region, you know, going forward. And, you know, that was 3 months ago, or that was 2019. Now, that strategic contemplative moment is that much more important. You know, the markets have changed. They have, you know, changed whether we wanted them to or not. They are going to change further still. And there are, you know, our industry is facing some measure of, or certain service lines in our industry are facing, you know, an existential threat. Parts of them will, you know, go away and are not likely to come back when we emerge on the other side of this COVID-19 crisis. When I'm in Hong Kong, I spend a lot more time, you know, contemplating those strategic initiatives, and not necessarily in all during my career. You know, what do I leave for the business in, let's say I retire in 10 years, what have I left by way of, you know, fertile ground for my colleagues to, you know, plow and sow themselves in, you know, in a decade. And it's as you well know, it's very different market to market. What is important to do in India is not necessarily as important to do in, you know, our Melbourne office. You know, what's important to do in Chennai is not necessarily what's important to do in Singapore. But those are things that I spend time thinking about. And most of my, you know, the time spent outside of Japan is, when I'm in Hong Kong, it's doing a lot of sitting and thinking, and it's doing a lot of talking to my colleagues, not necessarily always country heads, but department heads within countries, state heads, sometimes far, far further down the food chain. I love hearing the opinion of, you know, a very, very bright 26-year-old kid who's just joined our business following, you know, a master's program. These guys have a perspective that, and gals have a perspective that we don't, and that I certainly don't. So I spend as much time taking their input in as I possibly can. So again, in Japan, I quote unquote have to hit the pavement. When I'm out of Japan, I have the opportunity to spend a lot more time listening and thinking.
And do you spend a lot of time on the road, on visits out to Savills offices outside of your sort of two home bases? And do you think that, you know, having a sort of enforced period of change with regard to that, that it will lead to a more permanent change in the way that you travel or don't travel?
Yes and yes. So part one being, do I visit the other offices? I mean, my rough running metrics have always been a week to 10 days in Japan, a week to 10 days in Hong Kong, and a week to 10 days on the road every month. And the frequency with which I visit, you know, those markets is driven in, you know, by necessity in some part, by the sheer scale and volume of the business on the other side of that, which has always meant India gets a lot of time, Singapore gets a lot of time, Australia, just because it's far, gets slightly less, but like Australia gets a lot of time as well. Because the scale of our business there is, you know, has undergone a significant transformation over the past 3-4 years. And it's a place we're making a big bet. Yeah, do I travel a lot? I do. I spend a week to 10 days a month visiting other Savills offices that are, you know, part of my wheelhouse. Has it changed? Yeah, it's changed. Like, I came back from a 2.5 week long trip to Australia in early March. I'd visited our Sydney office, I'd visited our Adelaide office, and I'd visited our, not obviously Australia, but I went to our Auckland office. And upon my return on, I want to say it was around March 9th, I haven't seen the inside of an airplane since then. So it's, I mean, obviously for all the, you know, easily understood reasons, it's tapered off. Will that be a permanent fixture, or will that permanently adjust the frequency with which I visit those countries? Look, I suspect it's going to have an impact. Part of my personality is built on the places that I get to go and the people that I get to spend time with. And, you know, I was on a call earlier today with my India executives, and, you know, every fiber of my being is aching to get back there and see them again. And not just them, but see the country and the place that we've chosen to, you know, invest in as a business. Will it taper off? Yeah, look, the 4 countries in 1 week principle, I suspect that that's going to fall off, and I hope it does. If nothing else, this interlude in all of our turning up at the office, these various iterations of lockdown that have happened throughout Asia, have shown us that, you know, we can, and this applies to everyone, right? Regardless of industry, regardless of company, you can be much more productive at home and working remotely than you probably thought you could. So, you know, I and my, you know, wife and my dog will be very happy with the idea that I don't need to be perpetually in motion. But there's always going to be some of it, right? You have to see people. This is a people industry. You're driven by the relationships that you have, and those relationships need to be fed by, you know, there's a tolerable limit to what you can accomplish via Microsoft Teams and Zoom and, you know, phone calls. You need to see these people. You need to shake their hands. You need to sit with them and, you know, witness their body language as they articulate their frustrations with you and, you know, their requirements for you. So that part will never go away.
Yeah, it kind of, I feel for, you know, my business, it really focuses in two ways. So I realize that there's an awful lot that can be done kind of remotely, but at the same time, the human contact element is important in getting a better story, getting a better understanding of issues. And also, of course, it's more fun, which you can't neglect.
Exactly.
If it's a chore, it's not good.
Look, if I would assert that if meeting the people that are your clients and coworkers in the industry, whatever industry it might be that you've chosen, if that feels like a chore to you, then perhaps one could use this COVID lockdown time to reevaluate what's important to you. Because if you're not missing the client contact and the colleague contact that you have right now, then you're probably in the wrong business. So,
yeah.
I mean, I am cherishing the quiet time that I have at home. I love having figured out, as you rightly point out, what can I accomplish from home? What can get done without me having to be physically in an office? You know, and what parts of it clearly, demonstrably cannot. And those have become pretty apparent over the past few weeks.
You mentioned earlier, talking about the COVID-19 crisis and talking about existential threats to your business. So you're talking particularly about real estate or about the property advisory business? And could you tell me a little bit more about the threats to that business and also about your thoughts on how it might evolve over the next few years?
Again, as long as we go into it with the sort of prima facie comment or understanding that it is idle speculation and conjecture that is reliant more upon anecdote in a universe where no one's collated any meaningful data, neither us nor anyone that pretends otherwise.
Sure.
You know, if you take that as read, you know, I think we can all acknowledge that long before we found ourselves steeped in our current crisis, we had looked at a complete redefinition of what retail meant, of what the experience of retail meant. And retail as an asset class has found itself, you know, embroiled in some measure of difficulty. In some markets, retail is overbuilt and overdeveloped. The idea that, you know, emerging from this in a month or two, let's, you know, be optimistic and say that, you know, by June this year, everyone is back bouncing around in the streets, you know, the understanding that we've developed in the interim that there is a great deal more that you can procure by sitting in front of your computer that, you know, precludes the need for you to schlep yourself over to a supermarket or a department store, that's going to leave, I'm sure I'm not the only person that's experiencing that, right? That is going to leave a mark on, you know, a lot of what has always passed as traditional retail. You know, is it going to fall off a cliff? No, of course it's not. Is, you know, flagship retail and high street retail always going to be in demand? Yes, as long as, you know, people continue to have two legs and a desire to leave their house from time to time, then yes, that part of, you know, that sector is always going to be viable. Is it going to recalibrate itself in terms of demand? Yes. When we, you know, so what benefits from that when you shift the equation in that direction? Who benefits? Logistics. The logistics and distribution universe right now is going through an absolute orgiastic watershed moment where it's real importance, whether you're talking about large scale logistics or, you know, last mile delivery, those asset classes right now are being shown, however unexciting they may appear to be at first glance, shown themselves as, you know, they're absolutely critical in how human beings live their lives. And, you know, ask anybody that has missed an Amazon Fresh shipment for lack of last mile delivery facilities, they will tell you, you know, once upon a time, you know, the normal human beings who live in the world, you know, had no real awareness of what logistics meant. Now, every single human being that has gotten, again, a blown Amazon Fresh order understands the importance of last mile delivery, understands the importance of supply chain management. And so that as an asset class is going to go through the extent to which it has, you know, been avoided or ignored by some in the past, that is poised to change. And that's poised to change permanently. You know, retail will reconstitute itself. Retailers are very, very smart. You know, and retail operators, mall operators are very, very bright practitioners of their craft. They will figure out how to adapt. But that faces, you know, in the near term, faces a pretty significant level of crisis.
Yeah. And it's going to come down to the management and the skills of the retail managers as much as the investors and developers.
Absolutely. You know, the other side of that equation, which really, you know, one barely even needs to mention, is what happens in, you know, the hospitality and lodging space. There are operators and there are investors, right? There are people who own the real estate and there are people who operate the hotel. And I am fortunate enough to live in a market, you know, half of my life where, you know, it's not, you've got your international operators, but you've got a lot of very, very viable, very high credit domestic operators who are reliant not necessarily on tourism, but are reliant on a very mobile workforce in Japan. And some of them are, look, that mobility has basically had, you know, courtesy of, you know, the guidance that we've had from our prime minister, that mobility has been, you know, it's been shut down, or it's been the guidance is in place to suggest that it should curtail itself. And people are doing it. And hotel operators are hurting as a result. You know, do any of those guys face, we're not talking about insolvency, we're talking about crappy ADRs, and we're talking about lousy occupancy. You know, will it bounce back at some point in the future? It will. The question is, you know, for how long can a mobile workforce in a capitalist society, for how long can it endure a shutdown? Can it endure 3 months? Of course it can. Can it endure 18 months or 24 months? Who knows? Who knows? We've never been asked to, you know, no one's ever put that to the test. So I suspect that our colleagues in, you know, our friends, whether they be investors or operators in the hospitality universe, are going to feel more than a small pinch in the ensuing quarters. How long it lasts, I don't know. And perhaps existential threat was a tad bit of an overstatement, but as we've discussed in the past, Mark, I am prone to hyperbole. I think some of the asset classes will struggle, and those needed.
What about the office sector? I mean, so we're obviously working differently now, temporarily, and if some of that filters into permanent operations, does that mean a need for less office space or different office space? Or did it just mean that we carry on as normal and make sure you've got a good VPN and remote working system?
You know, I would love to tell you with certainty that I have an answer, and I don't, obviously. But yeah, there's certain observations, one made by it pains me to say it, but a competitor of ours has put forward an incredibly astute observation about, you know, the enduring importance of social distancing in respect of one's office requirements. And so, you know, even if you were to see more people on, you know, VPNs and working in their, you know, in their pajamas from home, the idea that you can pack people into an office with the same, you know, again, pretty aggressive in the absence of any workplace guidance or any workplace legislation that dictates how many cubic liters of oxygen every employee is entitled to, how much square footage every person should have. And let's be honest, right? In Asia, we don't have a lot of that. We don't have a lot of that guidance outside of Australia.
Yeah.
Imagine a universe where, yes, a third of your workforce is from home, but then all of a sudden, you have a 6-foot radius requirement around your desk and your social interactions in the office. So forget about hot desking. Forget about the idea that you're sharing a computer terminal. Forget about the idea that you're sitting at something that looks like a glorified, ridiculous coffee bar on a high bar stool on a counter where you're, you know, packed in cheek to jowl with someone. Look, I suspect that part of our industry is going to correct itself. So you know, the implications for office demand, look, I suspect, and that, look, that doesn't come without a cost either, right? I suspect there will be, you know, there will be a shift that says there are certain functions that can be done at home. And perhaps the idea of, you know, a remote working, maybe we're backward in this regard, I don't know. But the idea that you can have, you know, every employee or most employees can have a day or two a week of being remote, but when they return to the office, they'll find the office is far more generously spaced than maybe what they had been accustomed to so far. Maybe that serves to mitigate. I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know. I hope so. I suspect so. But again, my crystal ball gets very, very opaque when I start with these prognostications.
And how about the role of companies like Savills? I'm not just talking about, you know, what happens to Savills post COVID-19, but how you see the role of the property advisor or the broker developing, especially with so much technological change. I mean, prop tech has become, from sort of a neglected sector, it's become a bit of a buzzword. And there are always there's the threat of disintermediation for brokers.
Yeah,
look, that a concern for you?
Not really. Look, the disintermediation in the retail part of our universe has been, you know, it's a snowball that we've seen rolling down the Matterhorn for years now. The idea that individuals don't, especially again, the retail part of our universe has been disintermediated. unless you're talking about like the very, very highest end of pocket listings by, you know, a handful of residential agents, of residential intermediaries, if you will. You know, that trend has been, you know, building for years. You look at what's happened in the US and the UK in terms of the disintermediation of the residential space, you know, that ship is, you know, that it's sailed and it's not likely to reverse itself. In the commercial industry, in the commercial agency industry, you're not going to disintermediate, you know, someone selling a $500 million office building, whether it be in Singapore, whether it be in Tokyo, whether it be in London, whether it be in New York, Chicago, pick a jurisdiction, pick a gateway city on the planet. That's never going to fully disintermediate. It just can't. And for a million reasons that would require a separate podcast for us to discuss. So that's an open invitation to you to send a request. You'll never see full disintermediation from the commercial investment space. And, you know, I think even the most aggressive proponents of PropTech will have, you know, anecdotally, the ones that I've spoken to are in total agreement.
Yeah, I suppose at the most basic level, the numbers are too big for somebody to make a decision on the basis of an online listing and a transaction platform.
Are you going to buy a $100 million floor of an office building based on what you see on the internet? I can't bring myself to buy, you know, a $50 sweater on the internet. Are you gonna be able to hold your head high in front of your internal investment committee and your risk and compliance team, you know, who are gonna quiz you about anti-money laundering laws, about know your client requirements? You know, is anyone genuinely going to be able to hold their head up and say, yes, we managed to tick all of these boxes while sitting in, you know, Shengwan off of an investment opportunity in Beijing or in, you know, or in Kuala Lumpur or in Hyderabad? Are you going to be able to do that by sitting in an armchair? No. Is that going to require a physical, sentient human being to go and do most of the wet work for you? Yes. Ergo, the disintermediation of the commercial space, I don't see happening.
Yeah, yeah. You need somebody to go and kick the tires and make sure it's real.
You do.
Okay. Talk a little bit about how are your clients feeling at the moment. I'm thinking particularly of the Savills investor clients around the region. What would you say their mood is based on conversations you've had and conversations that your colleagues are having?
Look, our intra-regional clients, right? The clients that are, you know, our Asia-based clients, and this is geographically specific. So our, you know, we have our Japan megacorp Japan clients and our Singaporean clients and our, you know, our Chinese SOE clients, and, you know, my dear colleague Raymond has his, you know, his contingent or his cohort of clients in Hong Kong. Everyone turns inward in moments like this. Does that mean the transactions evaporate or dry up or die? No, they get postponed. They get drawn out. You know, in terms of cross-border investment interest, look, very not logically and very naturally, that, you know, the pause button has been hit on that. Yeah. Do they want to come back to certain markets with which they're familiar, where they've got track record? Of course they do. But, you know, that same principle that we were making light of a moment ago, you're not going to, if you are a German open-ended fund or a US life insurance company, you're not going to buy a building right now that you haven't had the occasion or opportunity to physically go and inspect. You just can't do it. So what does that mean in terms of volume? That means that volumes are, you know, if they're domestically focused, right? And Japan is a great example of that, right? The bulk of our trade here is domestic. You know, as the sentiment dimmed somewhat, the sentiment has forced itself into a moment of introspection where it's obliged to prolong the process. Nothing has died. You know, people are looking at this as, you know, a short-term and potentially medium-term disruption. Has it resulted in a dampening of enthusiasm? Look, broadly speaking, no. It's pushed things out. has it, you know, obliged people to, you know, go back and rekindle the relationships with their lenders? Yes. Has it obliged people to go back and rekindle relationships via their asset managers or their property managers with their tenants? Yes. Has it obliged people to look at the relationship between landlord and tenant as more of a partnership than a master-servant relationship? Absolutely. Does that translate into, you know, investor demand having fallen off a cliff? No. No. Unequivocally, no. We're seeing anecdotally, we've got deals in Korea that are closing at a very brisk pace, or at least going under contract at a very brisk pace. We have deals in Japan that are doing the same. We have deals in Hong Kong that are doing the same. Singapore, once people are allowed out of their homes again and real estate is treated as an essential service, mm-hmm. I suspect that you'll see a bit more of that there as well. This incident, this whole crisis is going to make the world in the near term, and possibly for some aspects in the long term, is going to make us a much more insular world. You're going to want supply chain to be able to be generated in your own country. You know, China, it pains me to say, but China is likely going to lose a bit of its luster as, you know, the world's factory, as some of these, you know, I'm not sure what sectors we should focus on, but some of these sectors are, you know, the auto industry, for example, is going to ensure in the United States that more of its products are made on shore. Now, does that happen in a month? Are you silly? Does it happen in 5 years? Impossible. That's a decade-long undertaking to recurve how your supply chain works.
Yeah. So, and these things were also happening to a certain extent as well.
Yes.
In terms of diversifying those supply chains.
Yes, yes.
Good. Okay. And something else I noticed, that there was a report earlier this week that the last year was a record year for real estate private equity fundraising. Mm-hmm. So the big market fundamental, i.e. the amount of capital aimed at real estate, is still right there.
It's there.
Just to kind of round off, thinking about the, not the far future, but look at the sort of the medium to longer term around the Asia-Pac region. Where do you see more international capital flowing over the next few years? Which markets would you expect to see more cross-border interest? And in which markets is Savills putting its investments as well? Give me a brief pause and then plow into where you see kind of capital flowing over the next few years, and also where Savills is kind of preparing to aid that capital.
Absolutely. So in terms of where capital is going to flow, right? You're going to look, with any state of normalcy returning over the next, you know, 3-4 quarters, you're going to see the traditional markets that have been, you know, fairly hot destinations with a high concentration of overseas capital, you know, attracting attention. You're going to see that, you know, that's not going to be interrupted. So that means Japan, increasingly Singapore, or increasingly Korea, Hong Kong, we'll see some. I don't think there's going to be much distress in Hong Kong, which is what typically investors look for there because it's very expensive.
Yeah.
You're going to see rekindled interest in Australia. Singapore is a perennial destination for overseas capital. And, you know, we've made some very big bets, you know, in Singapore in terms of bulking up our capabilities there. Uh-huh. We've made similar bets that are asset class specific in Australia. I think one element that is, you know, overlooked, and we've been talking about it at length internally over the past couple of weeks, and that is the great criticism that is oft leveled against India is a lack of dependable infrastructure and a general concern in terms of its dependability and its resilience as a marketplace. Whether you're talking about, you know, employees turning up at work, whether you're talking about the quality of the built environment, whether you're talking about the durability of, you know, a power feed, that is something that if it should find itself, if it emerges from this crisis, having performed the way it has performed thus far, and admittedly we're very early stage, if that market finds itself emerging from this crisis without being scarred from, you know, those concerns that have prevented large-scale institutional investment and development there in the past, I believe that that market is poised to absolutely explode. within the logistics space? Because, I mean, again, for a myriad of reasons that we could talk about, it would require a third podcast. I suspect that that market is poised to explode. It will prove itself to the universe that it has the infrastructure. You know, the question of talent is not put paid to. There is no question as to the talent and professional capabilities of the people that work there. In terms of the technical infrastructure of the built environment, if it rides itself out through this challenge, through this crisis, I suspect that that is a market that is poised to benefit considerably from institutional investor interest in the next, you know, 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's got, I mean, from a kind of the top-down picture in terms of size and demographics and growth, India has everything going for it.
It has everything going for it. I agree.
And what about some of the, say, not necessarily smaller markets, but some of the kind of more neglected Southeast Asian markets? Like, I know Savills is already quite big in Vietnam, but say Indonesia and the Philippines.
Indonesia, look, we've always held a... Indonesia is a very tricky market to figure out. We've, you know, dipped our toe in the water and then gone up to the knee and then retreated and have now made, you know, an additional investment and an additional bet there as well. It's a very hard market to work in. And again, for some of the infrastructure and technical limitations that the market has, it is... let's be candid, right? It's a country with an enormous population, vast natural resources, and all of the other underpinnings that make it a potentially very attractive real estate market. Is that going to unwind itself or make itself more decipherable to a foreign investor in the next decade? I don't know. My gut tells me no, but my gut also tells me that domestic local demand is more than enough to keep that market vibrant for the foreseeable future. From a commercial, you know, from a capital markets perspective, from an investment trade perspective. Occupier requirements there, whether they be, you know, a Korean bank or whether they be a Japanese retailer, there's going to be an increasing and inexorable amount of demand for space there. It's incumbent upon local developers to build the space that, you know, accommodates those needs. So, Indonesia doesn't scare me as much as some other markets. When I look across the Savills portfolio and the Savills offices, I look at Southeast Asia being a place that we've been fairly cautious over the past 15 years in terms of our expansion, you know, undertakings. Our Vietnam business is, you know, the envy of goodness. I mean, dare I say, many of our competitors, they have understood and deciphered that market and where certain services are required and where they are, where others are not. That market for us will be of increasing importance. The demographic picture of Vietnam is very, very favorable for Savills, for anyone really. Yeah. It's, you know, it's a young and very well educated population, and those are, you know, demographic. Those are highlights, right? That's where we gravitate.
Yes, yeah, that's the fundamentals, really, isn't it? Demographics for real estate.
It is. If you look at Thailand has got just such incredible potential that is largely untapped, due primarily, as we all well know, to some of the legislative and barrier to entry requirements that exist there. Mm-hmm. Will that change in the foreseeable future? I suspect not. Will it still be on people's list? Yeah, it always will be. Do all of us need to have an office there? Absolutely. There is, you know, an element that's not often spoke about is outbound investment requirements or opportunities for high net worth Thai individuals. They do invest overseas. Let's not act like it's, you know, entirely third world in terms of its economic makeup. It's not. There's a great deal of money in Thailand that wants to find itself a safe haven investment opportunity outside of Thailand. That trade, I suspect, will continue. Malaysia. You go ahead.
That's going to be also a continuing story for the whole region as well, isn't it? It's the capital that's moving from here to elsewhere in the world in real estate.
I suspect so. Asia was. Were I sitting with my colleague, one of my colleagues in Hong Kong, he would have, you know, be able to share with me the immediate statistics, but if you look at the amount of capital that, and this is almost anecdote, it's cliche to mention, the amount of money that flows out of Asia and invests itself in the United Kingdom, the United States, Western Europe, Australia, if you'll allow the omission of Australia as part of Asia, it is an inexorable wall of money. And this is the institutional money coupled with the retail exporting restrictions of capital that are in play in China, for example. Mm-hmm. Should there be any liberalization of those filters, the amount of money that flows out of Asia into the rest of the world it continues to change the dynamic of things. So I don't fear for, as long as the opportunity presents itself to travel again and go and kick the proverbial tires of what you're buying, you'll continue to see a wall of money pouring out of Asia Pacific into the West.
Fantastic. Chris, that's been very interesting. Great to chat to you. Thank you very much indeed.
It's been my pleasure, Mark.
Thank you for tuning into the Apria Leadership Podcast Series. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. We will be back soon with more episodes featuring industry leaders and dealmakers who specialize in cross-border transactions across Asia Pacific. If you like what you've heard and would like to give us feedback on future podcast episodes, please contact Sigrid Zialcita at sigrid.zialcita@apria.asia for more information. Please check www.apriaasia or follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter @apriaasia to get the latest updates.